Tempted to find a nice article to read to you tonight from a book on the history of anesthesia apparatus, and finding that there wasn't any, I started to play loud. I brought along a lot of things to show. I think the primary thing that we are interested in this evening is the story of the development of apparatus of anesthesia rather than techniques or the principles of anesthesia. And I know no better statement in brief than one in Buxton's book: "In primis, even at the risk of offering superfluous advice, it is urged upon those who hope to acquire proficiency in the use of anesthesia and anesthetics, that unless they realize to the full extent the responsibility which must be assumed by the anesthetist, they will never attain to even the foundation of their art. The timid and the reckless are equally dangerous, the one because he has no faith in his knowledge, and the other because he has never realized that his skill and knowledge alone stand between his patient and peril, possibly death. Whatever apparatus is employed, it should be personally examined before use, and the anesthetic employed should be smelt before being placed in or upon the inhaler. The armamentarium of the anesthetist should consist of the inhaler selected, an adequate quantity of the anesthetic which has been chosen as most suitable for that patient and for the particular case, which, if not known, an alternate anesthetic should be ready. All the instruments, rubber bags, face pieces should be carefully and thoroughly cleansed before and immediately after use. In cold weather, the rubber of tubes and face pieces should be rendered pliant by warming in hot water." I think this warning that we should know our apparatus from the very beginning is very well taken. I feel that anyone who goes in to the practice of anesthesia, even with all the advantages today, we sometimes hear jocularly and sometimes too much in earnest that the modern student in anesthesia is told to buy a laryngoscope, a tank of cyclopropane, and some curare and a needle, and he's all set to work. And unfortunately, occasionally, we have to go back to the very beginnings. Now, the laryngoscope is nothing new. We have the stories in some of these books in the Library Museum of intubations that were done long before the discovery of modern anesthesia. So just as proof that so little is new, I brought two items tonight. This particular item was manufactured by Farragher and Company for me in 1928. I have the bill for it. It's now known as the Ruth Bailey Anesthetist Bronchoscope. Dr. John Lundy of the Mayo Clinic, a very dear friend of mine, was attending one of our board meetings in New York. You are all acquainted with the wisp of cotton attached over the nose to indicate respiration, which John was quite gleeful about telling us he had discovered. So I took him over to the museum and showed him this inhaler, patented in London in 1888, 12 years before he was born. I think most of you can see the indicator, and I don't even have it on my face. Now, getting into a little bit more connected story, the history of anesthetic apparatus, of course, you can divide it into two parts, the prehistoric and the historic. And prehistorically, we had, we assume, the Babylonians, Chinese, Mongols, and so forth discovered, one way or another, the actions and function of cold and heat and of pressure. We know from some of the old writings that many, many years before Christ, they used pressure for deadening the pain. We know that the South American Indians discovered that spitting on a wound after chewing coca leaves made it hurt less or not at all. And so they had in those days some form of anesthesia produced either by ingestion or inhalation. They evidently had cups, so they couldn't have given the cup of nepenthe to the people that they were supposed to. And so from the shell, from the sea sponge, and perhaps even from dried moss and putting powdered stone on it and sard grapes, they could produce freezing action which resulted in anesthetic. They're your very beginnings of your anesthetic equipment. And one of the men who's famous in this institution at the Squire Clinic, Dr. J.B. Squire, was very much interested in the history of anesthesia. And he used to tell a story, which he didn't believe and none of us did, of the Egyptians who used a mallet and struck the back of the neck with a blow, as it was recorded, scarcely sufficient to crack the shell of a peanut, but in the right place would produce temporary insensibility. Now, as you go through some of these old books and find out the length of time that operations took in these early days, they explored the knee for a bullet, 2 minutes. Exploration of the knee for foreign body, minute and a half. Removal of the hip joint, 92 seconds. We don't operate that way anymore, so we've had to come to other things. Now, about the 9th century, jumping from 4000 BC to the 9th century, we come to the use of the soporific sponge. And one of our beloved leaders, Dr. Alf Waters, used to make one up at the Madison Institution, the General Hospital, and demonstrate it occasionally for groups. And it works. It was a mixture of various drugs which were soaked up into an ordinary sea sponge and then dried and then heated again and moistened, and the vapors inhaled, and that produced anesthesia. Now, historically, starting with about 1800 or 1795 with Beddoes, we come into one or two interesting facts. You all know that Sir Christopher Wren designed the great cathedral in London, and he was involved with nitrous oxide. James Watt, who discovered the steam engine, was the originator of the design for the first inhalers. And they're even carried down today in the Harcourt inhaler, which still uses the type that he designed with a leather insert and a metal covering. It was first suggested that a funnel be used. And of course, cupping the hands made a sort of a very crude beginning instrument. And so we have in the 9th century the anesthetic sponge used in some kind of cup. Again, in Italy in 1100, very definite descriptions of the use of the soporific sponge. By 1275, Lullius had discovered sweet vitriol, which, see, all things in medicine, if they're properly done, they're not dumped on the country like our recent fiasco. Takes a long time. It took 300 years from the time they made sweet vitriol and found that chickens could hurt themselves without seeming to realize they'd been hurt before anybody used it clinically. 1541, Valerius Cordus Do they know the story of Cordus?
I wouldn't.
Well, Valerius Cordus was supposed to be a priest. He had a father who was a physician, and he sent his son to a monastery to learn to write, because even the doctors, nobody but the priests could write at that time and in this area. So after he'd spent long enough to learn how to write, he decided he didn't like being a priest, and he wanted to write down the prescriptions that his very famous father had had such great success with. And there's your first pharmacopoeia. We have it in readable form in the Library Museum. Dr. Chauncey Leake owns it, and he loaned it to us for microfilming. It eventually will come to us. And in that, about three quarters of the way through, is the drawing of the retort and the little cap over it and a pipe leading off for the distillation of what we call ether today. Now that was in 1541, and it took from then until 1846 for the idea to really sink in. Back in 1646, much to my surprise, I'm presuming that I'm much more childlike than most of you, I thought freezing anesthesia was something quite new. But I found out that they had used freezing methods back in the Egyptian times, and Severinus of Italy used snow and ice for freezing, for operating. In 1656, we had the story of the use of intravenous anesthesia, intravenous injections using quills, using reeds, and hollow bones. Then we come down to 1795, where we have James Watt, whom I referred to, and I brought a picture of the gentleman. Well, we're passing over that picture. This is a picture of the morphine man, Sir Turner. It may be familiar to most of you. I'm sorry that I don't have these in slides. They're all being made, but they aren't ready yet. Lavoisier, Boyle, that's the Robert Boyle of earlier times. We also have a picture of the recent one. Here's the gentleman who I referred to, Valerius Cordus. This was donated to us by Chauncey Leake. This gentleman is Matas, I believe is the way he pronounces his name, and as far as I know, he's still living. He was very ill last summer. He's a member of our society. This is Dr. Robert Ferguson, whose inhaler I did not bring up. Dr. Ferguson occupied in the history of development of apparatus and anesthesia in general a position similar to that now occupied by Dr. Lewis Wright, advisor in anesthetics to the E.R. Squibb and Company. The Library Museum was to have been a memorial to Dr. Ferguson. That was my own idea when I went to see the Squibb people. But they said you can't have a memorial to somebody that's still living. Dr. Ferguson had the largest collection of anesthetic books and equipment in the world. He had over 600 volumes on anesthesia, which he promised to the library, and of which, because of carelessness in collecting, resulted in our getting 29 items. Gradually from other book dealers, we're picking up one or two now and then. This is a picture of a man you should know in the development of anesthesia, both in apparatus and otherwise, Gaston Labat. Dr. Labat went to the Mayo Clinic, and I borrowed his course while I was substitute interning in 1923 at Bellevue Hospital. This is Joseph Clover, whose development of the anesthesia apparatus, known as Clover's apparatus, was the first scientific advance from the very early open drop masks that had been proposed. Now, when you start in with, here's James Watt, a very small picture, I'm sorry. Can you see it? Now, we have him to thank for what we today use in anesthesia as an inhaler. And of course, I hope you realize that we still haven't found any ideal inhaler. We haven't found any ideal agent. We haven't found any ideal method of teaching even. We're approaching these things, but we haven't gotten there. Another one of our pioneers in the development of anesthesia is a man who lived just around the corner from our early headquarters in the Squibb building, Carl Kohler, died just a few years ago. We have over 1,000 of these. I only brought the one book. This is Ira McKesson, whose apparatus you know about, and who had so much to do with the development of American equipment about 1911. This is Thomas Bennett, of the Bennett inhaler, modification of the Clover Hewitt inhaler, anesthetist to Presbyterian and Roosevelt hospitals. Very interesting man. He was extremely well off. He and his brother owned the shredded wheat company at Niagara Falls, so he didn't have to worry about very much of anything. A very fine gentleman, incidentally. This is someone not so recently known to many of you. This is a picture of Dr. Henderson, physiologist at Yale. This is the Library Museum of the Australian Society at Malthura Road in Australia. I think you've been there, Virginia. And this is Jeffrey Kay, who is probably my counterpart in Australia. Now, these are some of our foreign well-known anesthetists: McIntosh, Nosworthy, and the present Edmund Boyle, Boyle's apparatus of London. Now, Dr. Ralph Waters is responsible, as far as I'm concerned, for the statement that if it hadn't been for a man by the name of Bigelow, Morton's work and Warren's work might have passed pretty much unknown. And Henry J. Bigelow, who was not the surgeon, but who, again, like Dr. Bennett, was able to travel, went all over the world. And it was he who spread the gospel of our what we call modern anesthesia from 1846 on to all of the countries. He also developed an apparatus that I may be able to describe. And this is our first scientific anesthetist anywhere. We have to take a back seat on that. John Snow of London really went to work as the first specialist anesthetist. You use the circle filter at times, perhaps even here, and that was devised by Brian Sword. And there, this is a picture of Dr. James Gwathmey, who had spent his last days in this hospital. Jim was a little bit deaf, and during one of the sessions at which I was present at Knickerbocker Hospital, there was a time when there was a certain force of wind which blew the windows out and disrupted the apparatus completely, but Jim said he didn't hear anything, and as far as he was concerned, there wasn't any explosion. Second picture of Dr. McKesson. This is Dr. Arno B. Luckhart, and Dr. Luckhart is well known to you for his work in ethylene. Very unfortunately, we are not able to get all of his collection. He's turned over some of it, but he got rather bitter a few years ago when there were a lot of ethylene explosions, and he was willing to travel anywhere in the United States to put any doctor through his paces that had used ethylene without the proper precautions, and we'll come to those in the development of apparatus. Now, this is a man to whom I owe my greatest allegiance for the work in organization. This is Francis Hoffer McMeekin. He was a complete wheelchair invalid at the end of his life, and yet he accomplished wonders. He has started the Organization of Anesthesia, the National Society, as a branch of the old Long Island Society. And we were in constant touch many times. You may even at this late stage hear that we were at odds. That's not true. This is his wife, Lorette, who still publishes the journal and is secretary of their society. Now, I referred to Dr. Squibb and Dr. Ferguson, and this is a little pamphlet that we were able to obtain for $35. Squibb's book on anesthesia and anesthetics of 1871. And he too has a paragraph or two that I think is well carrying in mind. Time that tries all things has disposed of many of the issues which arose in the early application of anesthesia, but has entirely failed in producing that universally applicable anesthetic, the philosopher's stone for which the alchemists of the profession still vainly search, namely, an agent which shall be potent, but potent only for good. This physical impossibility seems to be, to the medical profession, what perpetual motion is to the mechanic. And time wears away such heresies very slowly. It would doubtless be better for the profession, for mankind, if the anesthetics already known were better studied in relation to their special adaptations and were applied with a more wise discrimination. The condition of perfect anesthesia is one of the most grave and frightful conditions of life, and by suspending then more than half of vitality, it comes so near to death that it is wonderful to reflect how near the boundary line can be approached and yet be so rarely passed. Now, when you are attempting to go into the development of these aids in the administration of anesthesia, you'll find that, as I said earlier, there is no book on this subject. Dr. Fry of Heidelberg sent two of his students to this country this summer, and they've spent several weeks at the Library Museum writing what may turn out to be the first monograph on the development of anesthetic apparatus. The apparatus has always been important in the minds of the manufacturer, but don't forget the attitude. Back in my day, I started giving anesthetics in 1915 at Roosevelt Hospital when I was a first-year medical student and substitute intern. In those days, the anesthesia was given by the lowest man on the notch, and the person who should know most about it was off doing something else. In our internship there, the first 6 months, 3 months were on anesthesia and 3 months in the accident room, where you certainly ought to have somebody that knows a little bit about suturing, things of that kind. Now, I was handed a mask of this type and a can of ether and told to go ahead and give an anesthetic. And after we had a little old lady with white hair come in to have a wrist set, I did know enough to turn on some oxygen, and I didn't know enough to turn on anything else, so I gave her oxygen and held the mask tight enough so she couldn't yell until I took it off. And when I removed the mask and Dr. Stan Knapp said, it's all set now, She says, well, I tell you, that was the most brutal thing that was ever done. And I quite agreed. Now, we sometimes think that we are, in this country, the most cleanly, the most advanced, and all that sort of thing. Way back in 1880, they were using glass inhalers for chloroform and ether in Australia. This one, you can see the partial occlusion as we've been able to keep it. Starting now with the Morton era, we have this Morton inhaler, which adopted the sea sponge originally referred to. Morton went through many stages in preparing this, and I have, for those who are interested in digging this out, the records of the United States Congress, all about the trials to determine whether Morton invented these things, and in it are the descriptions of the various stages he went through. He used a tube first and simply stuffed a sponge in it. Well, the very first, of course, he used a pocket handkerchief, sprinkled ether on that. And then they got around to the idea they should have an enclosure. And I think you have a very beautiful example, which I'd never seen before, of anesthesia in without any outlet or inlet. This was valved only to the extent of the opening through which they added ether when necessary. You will notice the extremely small bore, and this stopcock is so arranged that it's very difficult to breathe through it at times if you get a little too much. We've taken it ether from this until we were completely anesthetized. Before very long, it became necessary to find a method of anesthetizing patients for eye operations. And Dr. Adolf Erdmann, the founder of the American Society of Anesthetists, was the man at the Norwegian Hospital in Brooklyn and several others there. And he devised this method of giving anesthesia for eye cases. This is not his dropper. He has a silver dropper, 8 inches long, but very similar to this. And there's a piece of lead, flexible lead, in addition to the foil. It simply fits over the nose in that manner, and the anesthetist stands out of the way of the surgeon and drops the anesthetic over the patient's face. Then, of course, we came along to dozens of these. I want to thank Dr. Pepper publicly for asking me to speak about this, because I had no concept until I started through these of the numbers of inhalers. It now appears to me, and I don't say this jokingly, that any and every anesthetist who ever gave more than 5 anesthetics invented some kind of apparatus to do it with. And if he didn't invent it, he modified something that was already there. Now, as the anesthesia equipment develops, we started off with a mask of this type. Then somebody came along and cut a hole in it. That was the next thing, so you could strap it on. Then the next man came along and added a little spray for oxygen. And then they put a wire around it so it would hold it in. Now, these come in all sizes and shapes. This one is known as the GAM ether mask, was developed by Dr. Greenfield of Ohio and was given to Dr. Wright by this Dr. Green in 1954. And this is an adjustable idea. You can open it up either direction, and it has a little wire gadget to hold the gauze on, and so that's the picture of that. We are interested in 2 pieces of equipment personally. because some of you are going to turn out something that will be perhaps as perfect and as lasting. You all know the newspaper headline stories of the pull motor, Roth Draeger pull motor. Now, I'm told by my mechanic friends that there have been attempts to modify the Roth Draeger pull motor, but none of them were ever successful. We have better machines today to do the same work. But for the many, many years that Dr. Roth designed the equipment and the Draeger Works put them out, they could not improve upon it. Its difficulty was its pressures were too high, 75 millimeters, both on suction and insufflation. Worked on the windshield wiper principle of both suction and pressure. Now this is a Roth Draeger mask. And we today don't have any mask that's worth powder to blow it up. So some of you got a chance right there, just like I had a chance now to talk about equipment. Well, this thing's mechanically frozen now, but it slipped off and a gauze sponge went in there, and there's a little valve inside here so that the exhalation went against this to allow it to build up a little CO2, and you dropped ether or chloroform or ethyl chloride on the gauze inside. Then about this time that they came out with the ideas in this country, John Snow, as I said, was an extremely scientific worker. He not only was a physician, politician, mathematician, botanist, and almost anything you can think of, but he was a very expert mechanic. And he devised with Watt the inhalers and the graduated gauges to weigh the various agents so that they would be given in exact proportions. And that was one of our next steps, was the Harcourt inhaler even before this one. This is a combination, ether and chloroform. This is a Harcourt inhaler almost complete. There was a little bottle that fits on this one side in which the chloroform was placed, and it contained two buttons of some material which floated when the tension of the vapor, when the strength of the chloroform reached a definite tension. And you could set it on this calibrated gauge so that the inhalations would give you the exact amount. One of the mechanical devices, you see, you could put your patient in almost any position and still hold it upright. Now, following that, we have the duplex apparatus, and this again goes back to Erdmann's idea with the lead face piece. It's broken off of here. There's only a little tiny rim of it left, but it had a malleable face piece and came the nearest to being perfect of anything that I know of, because it wasn't even an edentulous face, a long face, a short one. All you had to do was squeeze it or pull it out like plastic putty, and you could shape it to anywhere you wanted. But of course, it had the disadvantage of marking the patient. The thing was heavy, and you could grade the amount of air and ether that went in through this. This was in use in the late 90s. I mentioned the fact that Hewitt invented an inhaler, and that Joseph Clover invented one of the earliest good inhalers. This is an Omberdan, which is a rather poor copy and modification of Clover's inhaler. It's very heavy. It contained a water chamber. It contained a valve, which on the Clover inhaler gave you three positions, one, two, three, parts of air with ether. And in the final position, full ether, you really got full ether. This outside contained hot water, or water at room temperature. Now, they started off making nitrous oxide, as you remember, in little generators, and they're too big to bring up here. I'd have needed a truck. We have several of them at the museum, and we have some of the first portable outfits for manufacturing your own nitrous oxide as you went along. Little wooden box, about so big, containing the three bottles, and then a great big leather bag, such as you imagine in the penny dreadfuls that the old pack carrier used to have when he went from house to sell goods in the pioneer days. And they slung that over their back and filled it with 30 to 40 gallons of nitrous oxide, which they could manufacture for about 59 cents worth of chemical. The expensive part of the early apparatus was the decorations on the gasometer to hold the gas. If you had gold on it, it cost about $75. If it was just paint, it was $40. The bags were made, as I said, of various materials. Leather was used and recommended by James Watt, used by Beddoes in the Pneumatic Institute, and then during this one is fairly new. This was used in the First World War. They ran out of rubber, so they used parchment. You can pass this around. This machine is in regular use in Mexico and South America, and in parts of Europe at the present time. Why they use this in preference to clover, I can't see. It's heavier, and it doesn't do anything to my knowledge, the few times I tried it, that you can't do with a clover inhaler. Now we go back to one of our early little books. This is a book published in London in 1883 by Freeman. And it was customary in those days when you developed an apparatus or an agent to write a book about it. So here's the book. And he tells about prolonged anesthesia, sulfuric ether, composition of nitrous oxide, Dr. Colton's efforts to reintroduce nitrous oxide, and then he proudly presents his apparatus, which we have here. And he tells the method of its working and the Junker apparatus. Figure 2, we have a representation of Junker's gasometer. And here I have one of our very prized possessions from the Library Museum. This was one of Dr. Junker's own inhalers given by him to Dr. Erdman back in 1880-something, and presented by Dr. Erdman to the museum. Now, the reason I'm showing you that particularly is that when I came into anesthesia in 1915-20, I didn't graduate till 22, he wanted to know when. But as I told you, as a medical student first year, if you were lucky and got a chance to substitute, they put you on anesthesia, so that's how I got started. I was told this was a Junker inhaler. And there were some people in this country at that time, in the hospital I was working in, who used to walk around and wring their hands, "Come on, if you can't get them under ether, give them chloroform." Well, now, if you fill this with chloroform, as Junker's inhaler was filled with 3 tablespoonfuls, and you fill this with a bottle full, you very often have to have the coroner very soon. We're kind of proud of our Americans for developing apparatus that is so neat. There's a picture of the Junker, and the only difference, this one was given to Erdman with a hand bulb, and this one is shown with the foot bellows. Then they developed the bag, and I was speaking of the materials, the leather bag, and then very soon. We're kind of proud of our Americans for developing apparatus that is so neat. There's a picture of the Junker, and the only difference, this one was given to Erdman with a hand bulb, and this one is shown with the foot bellows. Then they developed the bag, and I was speaking of the materials, the leather bag, and then oiled silk, then two layers of muslin painted inside and out and the seams gummed to keep the gases in, and then parchment, and of course rubber as we use it today. Now there's a description picture of the clover inhaler. And I think we'll pass this around. The next page, that's on 34, and on 37 is the description of Paul Burt's room for operating, so that they could do chest cases and have all the pressures and so forth correct that we now do so easily with endotracheal tubes and cuffs. Now, so far I haven't said very much about anything but inhalation anesthesia, but in 1920, Paget in Spain developed epidural anesthesia. And of course, with Alexander Wood in 1853, devising the hollow needle, probably not the first, but he gets the credit for it, and Prévaz of France devising a hypodermic syringe. Now, the development of syringes from the old stick through a tube wrapped with tow and sometimes with linen has come on down, and we have just a few, very, very few samples of different kinds of syringes as of today. Of course, our most modern Becton Dickinson syringe now has interchangeable barrels. Our American equipment is so perfect that they can manufacture barrels that are interchangeable, which could not be done before. This, incidentally, of course, is a dental syringe, and they used it for getting enough pressure to go into the bony tissues. Along with that, we had the development of spinal anesthesia by Beer and others, and Matas was one of the first to introduce it successfully in this country. And we have a great variety of introducers and needles. This one is a gold needle, Seiss type, made by the Vim Company in Boston for Lincoln Seiss of the Lay Clinic. This particular one's been used in 400 administrations, and it's still as good as new, and you can bend it any way you want. That's its advantage. Very different. I didn't bring the earlier spinal needles, which I allowed the professor of syphilology to demonstrate using me for a goat, how you do a spinal puncture. And that needle was about that long, and it weighed a little less than a pound. And Dr. Fordyce, who was an ultra expert, put me down in a room like this in the old P&S at 59th Street, stripped up here and sat down on the chair, and he put his hand on my back, and I just felt a pinprick, and the needle was in. It was about a 14 gauge needle. I'm still lame. No, as a matter of fact, I never had any effect from it at all that I know about. That may be where my disc came from. This is another type of introducer. There are dozens of them, as I said. Everybody that used one, they want it filed off. They want the knurling a little bit different. They want the point a little different. And, of course, the development of equipment was the long point, the short point, and the great arguments in spinal and regional anesthesia about which you should use. And then they came out with the Huber point that was curved up, and one of these needles, if my eyes are sharp enough, is a Rovenstein needle with a hole in the side instead of on the end for directional anesthesia. Yeah, there it is. Introducer and all. Still have them. Then we came to the period, very early again. First, let's see, who knows? When was the first explosion reported in anesthesia?
Well,
Well, I think it will astonish you to know. You know, the first public demonstration of ether anesthesia was 1846, October 16th. In November, we had our first explosion. Another thing that's very interesting in the going over these things, you know, I like to quote old Abe Martin, or not quote, but give the gist of his thought. It ain't what you don't know, it's what you know that ain't so that makes all the difference. Now, I went through Key's book to find out the various steps in the development of anesthesia. Then I turned to a German book. I don't have one in French on this. And I have Duncombe giving the British idea. And the dates and the persons are quite different. I brought tonight and showed Dr. Papper this book, which we've just been able to get. There are only four or five copies of it left. Diefenbach, Ether Anesthesia, 1847, Germany. And he tells all of the different things they did with it and the apparatus that they made and how it was made. And unfortunately, I had to struggle for 10 minutes with each word, but he knew what he was doing. Now, we've seen the picture of McKesson. He was the first one in this country to put out really scientific apparatus where you needed an engineer's license and a doctor's degree and a chemist's knowledge to operate it. We had the Nargraph. It was supposed to be an apparatus which would be almost as automatic as you've developed up here. And the only trouble was that one and all its successors to date that I've ever had anything to do with, and this must be very fair. Now, please don't get the wrong impression. I went to the last show, and the McKesson salesman said, "Well, Wood, we've got a machine now that does not leak." And I said, you sure? And I turned the first valve. Now, accuracy in, we're way over time, Manny. Accuracy was Carl Connell's idea, as well as McKesson's, and also Guathmey's. And very briefly, I'll go over those, and I think we'll have to call it quits, and you'll have to come down to the library and see these things. We have 800 of these down there. I just brought these few things up in two boxes. So anybody that's interested in knowing the beginnings of equipment, you can get it there. These three men that wanted the accuracy, Guathmey sold out for the bubble machine. And I started giving anesthetics at this hospital under Miss Penland. Gave gas oxygen with giving a of nitrous oxide and a of oxygen. Worked. Then Guathmey's machine came along and it had holes drilled in it. There were four holes in the oxygen pipe and five in the nitrous oxide. And they calibrated it at the manufacturers, and it was a great improvement over the system. But even that had to be modified, and we came along to modern equipment. And this is the first. Heidbrink gauge for carbon dioxide, for cyclopropane. You may know or may not that all of Waters' work, Rovenstein, Stiles, Neff, and the group, was done with a carbon dioxide gauge. The two weights are so similar, it didn't make much difference. But in the interest of the Library Museum, we asked all the companies to manufacture a calibrated cyclopropane gauge. And I have the first Farragher gauge, I have the first McKesson, I have the first Heidbrink. Now, developing anesthetic equipment to show you how it develops. Here again is almost a Hewitt inhaler, known in this country as a Guathme. And that was modified before Guathme changed it by Tom Bennett. I only brought part of Bennett's, but here is the machine that Furnace used. And you can see the tube that he brazed on in his office. He was always fiddling with machinery, and this is the commercial model. So that's the way these things develop. Now, when we get down to self-administration, I haven't gone into that at all. Art Goodell wrote a pamphlet on the self-administration of nitrous oxide for childbirth. And we have one of the very rare copies here. And Art said he would pay almost anything to have it back. I think you'll find it very interesting. Bennett also developed a piece of apparatus for obstetrical use, consisting of a metal tube about 3 inches tall and about a half inch in diameter, with a lip and a tight stopper. And the patient, the anesthetist, filled the thing with either ether or chloroform, preferably chloroform for Bennett, on a piece of gauze, and the patient would put it up their nose and inhale, and as soon as they got enough, it fell down, and so they didn't get too much. That's the principle that Flagg used in the tin can. You'd take an ordinary ether can and punch holes in it, hook it up to a tube that goes down into the throat, not endotracheal, but just in the back of the throat. And by the patient's respirations, if he gets light, he breathes faster, he takes in more. When he gets too deep, he slows down, and it's quite automatic. Now there's the beginning of the Connell equipment. The Connell equipment, like the McKesson equipment, was supposed to be automatic. You set a little button on it for the first 3 or 4 minutes, and then you could go off to the next county and plant beans. It was all up to the patient. Now you can see the changes that were made from the Bennett inhaler, which looked like this. In order to make a true Bennett, as we had them in the early days, just assume that this chamber's up here. Now this was used for the gas induction. Then after a patient was under gas, there were valves in the upper piece so that you could either have the patient rebreathe, or preferably the first 3 or 4 breaths went through the machine into the patient and then out through an exhaling valve. Then after you were ready to go into straight anesthesia, took that off and hooked on this bag, and ether was administered on the gauze, which I imagine is still in this one. And that would hold about an ounce of ether and would last from 15 minutes to a half hour. And this was gradually turned up, just as on the Clover and others, so that you started with a hole straight through, which you can see, and then as the machine turned, you got more and more ether, and air was admitted through this part. If they didn't get enough air to keep pink, well, then you can put the gas part back on and give them oxygen, or slip a gas tube underneath. Now, following along with Water's idea, Ohio Chemical came out with this for the self-administration of cyclopropane. This is only the breathing part of it, but this again brings in the teeter face piece, celluloid now, and you can see how those changes have occurred. One or two things that are originals that I'd like to show you, and then we must quit. You've seen the original Waters inhaler, absorber. That's the very first one that was used in Madison on the modern absorption experiments. It's interesting to note in regard to that, that while Guathme was in the First World War in London, he wrote to Forager in 1919, and we have that letter framed in 3 frames at the library. saying that they were using so much nitrous oxide and it was so hard to transport and so heavy that if he could just figure out some way to put something in the bag that would absorb the carbon dioxide, they could use it over and over again. In 1923, Waters came out with the principles devised by Jackson. About 3 o'clock one morning, I got a phone call from Washington, D.C., and Joe Kreiselman says, "I finally got the idea. This is it, the resuscitator. And this is now used in all the planes and all the boats, the Navy and the Air Corps and whatnot. Each squad has the commercial model of it." As far as explosions, development of apparatus from that, you know of the Horton intercoupler, you know of the wet towel. We started off with a gadget like we used in the early days of radio, and that was supposed to be good enough, this little plate on the floor and this draped around your wrist and over the patient. The experiments that were run by Dr. Mather Cleveland of this institution and myself at Seaview Hospital, we used a Seattle model apparatus and hooked it up with a fish line and a fish reel, copper fish line. And we connected this with each nurse, with each surgeon, and we rigged it up with a relay and a little light. And we found that in 7 operations when we used it, that on the average of every 7 minutes, somebody broke the circuit, so what the heck. Now the last of the originals, this is the first tube that Waters and Goodell used with the cuff. There's part of the cuff still visible. And this is Tovell's contribution, endobronchial endotracheal anesthesia. This was his idea. I certainly appreciate your patience and courtesy in listening to this description of some of the high spots. It's way beyond me to go into the equipment that you have here today, because it doesn't work with a whoosh, but if any of you are interested in going further into these things, we have a great many books. I had hoped to talk a little faster and tell you about the first resuscitation. I showed you this Kreiselman resuscitator. Back in Fothergill's day, they used an iron pipe about 6 feet long in the rectum and blew tobacco smoke in. That was supposed to resuscitate patients. Well, as Tom Buchanan used to say, that Dr. Gwathmey introducing in this country rectal anesthesia came in by the back door. It's time for me to go out by the back door.